What costs $1 trillion and is unpopular with just about everybody? The compromise farm bill passed by Congress, or passed by the House yesterday, 251 to 166. 162 Republicans and 89 Democrats voted in favor of it. So I guess we can call that bipartisan support. So what's in this thing? I mean, it's huge. $1 trillion over 10 years, that's still a lot of anybody's money. We're going to talk about what's in the bill, and particularly in the Badger State here, or the Dairy State, as we prefer to call ourselves, I think, what's in it for dairy farmers in Wisconsin. Andy Novakovich is a professor of agricultural economics at Cornell University, former chair of the Department of Agriculture's Dairy Industry Advisory Committee. His Wisconsin connection is that he is a UW River Falls graduate. Go Falcons. Professor Novakovich, welcome to the Joy Cardine program.
Thanks very much.
And in particular, thank you for getting up so early. You're in California. Wow, it's really early there.
Yeah, that's it.
So, well, you're getting up with the cows, I guess, would maybe one of the ways to look at this. So we finally have a farm bill. It looks like the Senate will vote to pass it, and it looks like the president will sign it. This whole thing could be wrapped up by next week. So let's start out with a little scorecard thing here. Who are the winners and losers in this bill?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm out here at an industry meeting, and as I've spoken to processors and farmers and folks working with co-ops, honestly, the greatest sense is just relief that it's done. I actually think so many people have been just worn to a nub by this that they're ready to say, great, you know, we got something, let's move ahead. I think, you know, a tally of winners and losers always kind of begs what you're using to evaluate winning and losing. I think this, if we focus just on the dairy part, I think this approach that's being pulled together is a pretty good deal for consumers. I don't think it's going to really change the consumer equation in any particular great way at all. I don't think it's going to really affect processors in any great degree. And I do think it offers a very meaningful program for all farmers during times of financial stress. This year certainly doesn't look like it's going to be one of them, but we know that down the road, stuff is going to happen. And the bill very much tried to focus attention and make it easier to get into the program for smaller scale farmers, farmers in the 150, 200, 250 cow range, which, you know, I still have a hard time thinking it was small, but in the grand scheme of the national size distribution, that's probably a fair categorization. But even large scale farmers will find pretty meaningful insurance levels quite affordable. So, you know, that's a good thing for folks who have really been through the roller coaster.
So, how does this change work? As I understand it, and I'm using understand probably in italics here, the kinds of direct payments that farmers used to get, and not just dairy farmers, is being replaced by a sort of risk management system where there'll be insurance in place to kind of cushion the effects of big price changes in milk prices?
Yeah, well, there's probably two categories worth getting clarified about. If you look at the crop side, cash crops, corn, soybeans, wheat, those were the guys that were getting the direct payments. And, you know, at the time that legislation was passed in 1996, it made all kinds of sense. But over time, it just seemed to be, why are we doing this again? And so the pressure to get rid of that was pretty intense, and they were gone. They were going to be history. What came in was a strengthening of crop insurance, which pretty much everybody agreed was the right way to go. But there was some anxiety about what came to be known as shallow losses. So crop insurance kicks in when things are really quite bad, but in periods that were stressful but not catastrophic, there wasn't really anything there. And the absence of direct payments, which kind of covered that, was notable. So two programs were created, both of which are kind of familiar to people who work in these major crops areas. And they both offer a kind of a price protection at that sort of shallow loss level. On the dairy side, we didn't have direct payments. We didn't have automatic checks going out no matter what you did. We had the MILC program, which is kind of a counter-cyclical program. When prices got below a certain level, you could qualify for a certain payment. We found in 2009 that that program was just way too anemic, and that's when we started to think about, gee, what can we do to address our situation better? So the program that we have now is being referred to as margin insurance, margin producer payment program. And that structure allows producers to establish a production history, establish a base quantity. They get to say what percentage of that quantity they'd like to put into an insurance program. And then they get to choose coverage levels that range from really bad to actually just barely below average. And, of course, as they purchase or try to purchase higher levels of coverage, then the premiums increase. And, in fact, if you're a larger-scale farmer at the highest level of coverage, the premiums are very expensive. So that's a general idea. And if a national trigger comes into place, if we look at the price of milk on average in the United States and compare it to a calculation of the average cost of feed and say that represents a margin, if that margin hits these various different trigger levels and you signed up for coverage at that level, it triggers a payment to you. These are calibrated in spans of 2-month periods, so you could get a payment for 2 months, and that's it. It never happened again during the year. If there's an extended period, you might get a payment for 6 or 8 months.
So for the average dairy farmer in Wisconsin, and I don't even know if you can talk about an average dairy farmer in the state anymore, but for the average farmer in Wisconsin, did this turn out to be a good thing or a bad thing? I know that our congressional delegation here was split on this, with some saying, yeah, this is a great deal for our dairy farmers in the state, and others not so sure.
Yeah, well, of course, you're absolutely right. You know, there might be some numerical average Wisconsin farmer, but the range of opinion, the range of business structures in that state, and it's also true in New York, by the way, is gigantic. As I observed this unfold over the last couple of years, I think there was a strong majority of farmers who looked at the bill that was originally proposed by the National Milk Producers Federation and said, you know what, I don't know exactly if this is going to work, but we need some strong medicine. We need to do this. Well, that bill that was proposed and which didn't quite make it all the way included an insurance program like the one that's in the Agricultural Act of 2014, but it also included a piece that would try to restrain production in periods of financial stress. People who were proponents of that plan called it market stabilization. Earlier it was called growth management. People who didn't like that plan called it supply management. Speaker Boehner called it Soviet-style dairy policy. Well, most folks, dairy farmers, I think, were ready to give it a try, weren't entirely sure if it would work, but thought it had merit. However, there was a very vocal group of producers who really thought that was going too far. It was way too intrusive. The U.S. government shouldn't tell me how many cows I should milk. And they were fundamentally opposed to it. It wasn't an issue of would it work, but more an issue of I just don't like this path. I don't want to go down it. This is just wrong. And processors were very vocally opposed to that supply management. They thought it would be disruptive to their business, and it would hit different areas of the country unevenly, and that would be troublesome. But at the end of the day, it was Speaker John Boehner's absolute hard rock insistence that this would not be in the bill that doomed it.
We're going to be continuing to talk about the farm bill throughout the rest of this hour, and wondering what you think. What did you think of the farm bill that passed the House? Is this a good piece of legislation? Do you think it costs too much? Do you think it hurts the poor? What would make it better? Or is this about as good a deal as we're likely to get? And what questions do you have about it and how it works? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Talk@WPR.org is the email address, and you can also find the Joy Cardine program on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. Again, 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Andy Novakovich, professor of agricultural economics at Cornell University, right after this timeout. I'm John Munson. You're in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, it took a while, but we finally got a farm bill. The House passed it yesterday, the Senate is expected to act next week, and the President is expected to sign it, and we'll have a farm bill. It took a couple of years, a lot of negotiating, and finally it sounds like everybody was just exhausted enough to say, okay, we just got to get this thing done, and that's it. But we're talking about what's in it and what it means for those of us in Wisconsin, not just farmers, but consumers and everybody else. My guest is Andy Novakovich, professor of agricultural economics at Cornell University, former chair of the Department of Agriculture's Dairy Industry Advisory Committee, and he's a UW River Falls graduate. And he was kind enough to get up really early out in California to join us on the Ideas Network this morning. 800-642-1234. If you'd like to join the program with your comments or questions, particularly, I'd like to hear from farmers. Although this is maybe a pretty busy time of the morning for you, but if you could spare a moment and give us a call, how do you think that this bill is going to affect you? That would be one thing I'd like to know. Professor, one of the things that grabbed a lot of headlines in this bill as it was being negotiated was changes in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, $8 billion in cuts over the 10 years of the bill. The House originally wanted $40 billion. Senate Democrats had called for about $4 billion, so nobody really got completely what they wanted. But at the end of the day, what effect is this cut going to have on those who are in the SNAP program, do you think?
Well, the cuts that eventually were decided upon don't do anything to change the benefit levels. But what they do is change how people can qualify for the food stamp program. It's not even eligibility. The eligibility rules are basically the same. If you hit the trigger levels for income and characteristics of your family, you're going to get the same food stamp program that you had before. In the debate that ensued between the Senate, which had very modest cuts, and the House, which had much larger cuts, it really focused on not, you know, cutting some budget number, but changing the rules. There was a feeling among many who supported the larger cuts that this had evolved into kind of an overblown welfare program that made it too easy for people to get benefits, and that really didn't help them get into a situation where they could take care of themselves. Supporters of food stamps said, hey, you know, this is about people who are going through some serious trouble. Most of the recipients are children and elderly people, and you know, this is a good program. We should support it. I should add that although the children and older people numbers is definitely true prior to 2010, during the Great Recession, we had a very large number of people enroll who were not children and who were not retired. They were people who were put out of work primarily. And so the number of folks that are on food stamps has grown tremendously since the Great Recession. The money that's being spent has grown accordingly. And that's where the struggle is. Gosh, it's a lot of money. It's a good cause. But, you know, long term, it's just the right thing to do. At the end of the day, they did something really quite simple and fairly small. They focused on the fact that there are 16 states that have a program to help people pay their heat bill. If you qualify for the program, you get a subsidy. In some cases, the subsidy is just a couple bucks. And these states who control the sign-up, food stamps, said, if you qualify for the heating subsidy, we're going to have to let you automatically qualify for food stamps. You don't have to check the numbers. You're just going to get automatic categorical eligibility. And on the face of it, that sounded crazy, that you know you could get a $1 heating subsidy and qualify for food stamps. So that provision was changed. You now have to get, I believe, the number they settled on is $20 a month. But at the end of the day, all that does is change what you have to do to qualify or be eligible in those 16 states. And the actual underlying eligibility rules for the food stamp program and the benefits that the food stamp program would pay are unaffected. A bigger effect was when the Great Recession period supplement the food stamps terminated and went back to the earlier number. And for a lot of families who continue to be unemployed or in financial distress long-term, that cutback was pretty tough. But that didn't have anything to do with the Farm Bill.
We've got some callers who want to join us. Let's take a call from Rana in Rice Lake. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Professor. I'm just wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on the changes in the subsidy program. And as I was waiting, a second question popped into my head. Is there anything in this new Farm Bill that will help or hinder new people coming into production agriculture? I'm an ag education teacher, and I have lots of students that consider production ag as a career choice, but it's getting difficult to become a startup business. So I'm wondering if you can elaborate on those two points.
Sure. With respect to subsidies, of course, there's all kinds of pieces within the Farm Bill that somehow assist producers. If you're a corn grower, there's a massive structure of crop insurance, and now these so-called shallow loss type programs. If you're interested in improving the environmental and conservation aspects of your farm, there's programs that assist with the cost of that and putting together plans to do that correctly. Of course, there's money that's allocated to cooperative extension, experiment station work to try to help create knowledge and disseminate it. The dairy program is going to offer much greater levels of assistance to farmers during creative financial stress. So that general thrust, I think, actually is pretty much continued. It's taking a little different form. But the magnitude of that kind of assistance to farmers, I would say, is largely undisturbed. And having said that, one thing that I would add is farmers more and more are going to find they got to step forward and participate. They got to get some skin in the game with paying premiums. They're going to have to get more involved in making sure they're doing things right and in a sustainable way. That trend, as you know, just continues to push forward. So, just walking out to your mailbox and opening up and finding you got a check from the U.S. Treasury isn't going to happen anymore. And so it's going to require more participation, more effort, more skin in the game by all our farmers. In terms of new entrants, the bill doesn't do anything broadly new, but there is a continuation of existing programs sponsored at the federal level to help young farmers, to help farmers in minority groups who often don't find it as easy to move into land ownership. And that's a big deal in Wisconsin and New York, but in some parts of the country, very important. And so those programs continue. Since I was on the Dairy Industry Advisory Council, I actually have accepted a part-time appointment with USDA, and it's given me an opportunity to get to know USDA's programs a little bit more intimately. And I can tell you, the Secretary of Agriculture is deeply, deeply committed to doing as much as he possibly can with the tools available to him to try to assist the development of agriculture and particularly getting new people in. And, you know, it's a challenge, no doubt about it. You see it in upstate New York. You see it in northern Wisconsin. You see it in western Nebraska. But there are programs at the federal level, and it is a genuine, serious priority for Secretary Vilsack. In addition to these programs, a really important aspect is credit availability. And I think Wisconsin in particular has a very good story to tell in that.
Well, and I want you to tell that story, but we're up against a hard break for the news. So hold that thought, Professor. We'll come back. We'll talk about credit availability as either a barrier or a way in on the production side of agriculture. We're talking about the Farm Bill that passed the House yesterday, is expected to pass the Senate. The president is supposed to sign it. We'll continue that discussion on the other side of the news. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We call it the Farm Bill, but that's shorthand. At any rate, it took a couple of years of wrangling to get it passed, and maybe out of sheer exhaustion, we finally got an agreement. Yesterday, the House voted to pass the Farm Bill, and now it's in the hands of the Senate. They're expected to pass it. The president is expected to sign it. And then we have ag policy that's actually a matter of law instead of the kind of limbo that the entire industry has been in over the last couple of years. We're talking about what's in the bill, who the winners and losers are, and what it actually means. And with our guest, Andy Novakovich, professor of agricultural economics at Cornell University, former chair of the Department of Agriculture's Dairy Industry Advisory Committee. More important to us, he's a UW River Falls graduate. And he got up really early out in California to be on the program this morning, and I'm very grateful. 800-642-1234, the number to call. We have some callers. Let's start with Phil in Kenosha. Phil, good morning.
Good morning. I was curious about the SNAP program. I know with a lot of government programs, when they lift cuts to a program, it could have a proposed $10 billion increase per year, and they only increase it to $4 billion, and they'll list that as a $6 billion cut. So are the cuts versus previous year's spending, or is it cuts in proposed increases?
Thanks for the call, Phil. Professor?
That's a great question. And the United States Congress does something that I think is a little different than most of us would think about. When they say we're going to cut something by 10 or we're going to increase something by 20, they're not saying relative to what we just spent. They're saying to what we would spend if we didn't make any changes to the law. And in addition, it's always calibrated in new legislation relative to the next 10 years. And typically when they talk about, you know, we're going to cut $40 billion from food stamps, that's actually the total projected savings, if you will, for the next 10 years compared to what you would have spent if you hadn't made those changes in the law. And so, you know, this $40 billion averages out to more like $4 billion a year. And you could be spending a whole lot more than you did the previous year, because that doesn't matter in this calculation. It's relative to what you would have spent anyway, which is fine, I suppose, but it's probably a little different than most of us think of. You can actually say you cut something and spend more money on it than you did the year before.
Thanks for the call, Phil. Before the news break, Professor, you were talking about credit availability and what, you know, that is seen in some cases as a barrier to entry into the industry, or it can be a big help if credit is available. Why don't you finish that thought, and then we've got some emails and some more calls to take.
So for a lot of young producers, new entrants, getting the money together to start the farm is the largest barrier, and there's more than a few, but that's a big one. And there's probably four major ways that a producer can come up with the money to finance a new investment like a farm. One is certainly just going out into the commercial lending system. Wisconsin has an especially good banking system that has a lot of smaller scale banks that knows agriculture and has been a real bulwark for providing short and long term loans to the industry for many, many years. I think that industry knew how to evaluate loans for people that wanted to start farms of a modest size, but really was challenged to figure out what do you do when a guy comes in the door who wants to have a 3,000 cow farm. In Wisconsin, but even more so in the Northeast, the farm credit system is important. Farm credit is the major lender in the Northeast, and commercial banks are far less important. And they operate in many ways much like a commercial lender, but farm credit for sure knows agriculture, and depending on the standards of the local banks, can be very good at providing credit and working with new farmers. Another big program, and one that I think Wisconsin does especially well, probably better than any other state, is the state FSA loan program, which is largely for farmers who are a little more disadvantaged in terms of their credit worthiness. And the state of Wisconsin has done a good job with that. And there are special programs within the FSA loan program for beginning farmers and ranchers. But for a lot of folks, the biggest source of money is actually personal, the family equity that slowly allows people to get into the business. And I think in many parts of the country, that personal family financing model works a little bit better for the larger scale farms that allow a younger family member to come in at a modest level and then gradually over time grow into acquiring the business. That happens at every size and can certainly happen with a smaller farm, but it's a tool that's a little bit easier to use when you've got these large-scale operations.
One of the groups that was not happy about the outcome of the deal that created this new legislation is the meat industry. They didn't like it much because it keeps the country of origin labeling rules, or COOL as it's known, in place. And why is the meat industry not happy with COOL?
Well, the big issue for them is actually the kind of issue that often upsets producers and processors, and that is this country of origin labeling has become an issue that's deterring their ability to move meat products out of the country. And they're getting a lot of hassle, particularly from Canada, about trade. And nobody wants anything to get in the way of our ability to sell product. I think it's safe to say that most consumers really appreciate knowing something about where their food is produced, and most of us would have a preference for food made in America. But once you get outside the borders, this becomes pretty tricky. And for people who want to import to us, there's also been pretty serious protests, legal-type protests, about this as being unfair trade barriers. So it's largely in the trade domain where that becomes a touchy issue.
Yeah, I maybe I'm just dense, but I'm what difference would it make? I mean, if we have to label the food in terms of where it was produced, how does that prevent food from coming into the country or being marketed here?
Well, in the case of cattle, it's kind of especially funny. What does it mean to say this hamburger, this steak, originated in the United States? And it probably sounds absurd, but suppose you bought the calf from Mexico or Canada and moved it to Texas. It was fed out in Texas. It was slaughtered in Texas. It was distributed in the United States. Is that hamburger an American hamburger? Or do we get into some kind of Obama birth certificate thing and say, where was the calf born? Suppose the cow dropped the calf in Texas, and you took the calf to Mexico to feed it out, and then you brought it back in to process it. Is that an American hamburger? Now, you might think I'm making this up, but this is exactly the kind of thing that was talked about. If the beef producer was located in Kansas or Ohio, they wanted 100% American. They wanted to see that birth certificate. They wanted to know that you never got a passport. They wanted to know that you died in an American processing plant. If you lived in Texas or Montana, it was like, hey, come on, you know, this guy hardly speaks with an accent at all. Let's cut us some slack. Canadians are saying, you know, you're getting young stock from Canada, and you're taking it to Montana and getting it processed, and now you're saying, you know, you can't count it. And actually, at the end of the day, what the heck's the difference between a steer from Alberta and a steer from Montana? So once you get in the weeds on this stuff, it turns out you can find all kinds of stuff to argue about.
Hmm. Well, things are hardly ever what they seem at first. We've got some phone calls and some emails to take yet, and you have to leave pretty soon. So I want to go to a break quickly and then come back and take a couple of calls before you have to leave us. We're talking about the ag bill that passed the House yesterday and should pass the Senate next week and be signed by the president. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So the Farm Bill passed the House yesterday. We're talking about what's in it, winners and losers, who's happy, who's not, what it all means, with Andy Novakovich, professor of agricultural economics at Cornell University and a UW River Falls graduate. Let's see. Let's go to the phones. We'll take a call from Bill in Lancaster. Bill, good morning.
Good morning. The biggest problem I have with the Farm Bill is it isn't a farm bill. It's a food bill. They use the word farm simply because people then cue the iconic red barn in their head and the farmer with deep lines in his face standing in front of his crop of corn. Well, American agriculture isn't that anymore. When lobbyists go to Washington, they're not talking about the small farmers or even the mid-sized farmers. They're representing Kraft and Nestle Corp, Monsanto, Syngenta, the Cattlemen's Association, pork producers. And the only reason these people are lobbying is for self-preservation. The corporations want to return profits to their shareholders. The associations want to maintain membership. And the small farmer, the mid-sized farmer, even to a certain extent, the large farmer is kind of left in the dust. They don't really care. They're just kind of an afterthought.
Bill, I our guest has to leave in about 5 minutes, so I want to give him a chance to respond. It's not a farm bill. It's a food bill, Professor.
Yeah, there's a couple things there. I mean, if you look at the money spent on the programs that come under this large piece of legislation, 80% or so is for food assistance programs. It's not all food stamps, but food stamps is far and away the biggest, but there's several programs that come under that umbrella, and that's where most of the money goes. We've got conservation programs that take up a pretty good chunk. Crop insurance takes up a large chunk. Other agricultural programs take up a pretty big chunk. But definitely the food assistance is the biggest part of the budget. If you look at what USDA does in terms of its employment, it doesn't match up quite the same way. There's a lot of people involved in agricultural programs.
In fact, the largest block of employees in USDA is with the Forest Service. So, you know, how big something is depends a little bit maybe on how you measure it. I know there's a lot of frustration about whether or not U.S. agricultural policy has been there for the smaller scale farmers. I completely understand that. I know it's a concern in Wisconsin where I grew up. I know it's a concern in New York where I've lived for 30 years. But I'm going to say I've worked with people in Congress for a long time. I've worked with people in USDA for a long time. And the situation is not as bad as Bill describes it. It may look like the big food companies get what they want, but that's not been my experience. And I've been in the offices of elected officials who very sincerely talk about what can we do and who are frustrated by the fact that they can't really do a whole lot more. So I know where that sentiment's coming from, but my experience is it's really not that bad.
When we have a long history of things like price supports and subsidies and so forth, and that whole system is changing, but we're still providing that assistance to farmers. Some people feel that these types of subsidies basically fool us into thinking we actually pay the real cost of what it takes to put food on our tables. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, it's a point you can argue a lot of different ways. Crop insurance has been the poster child for what's good about agricultural policy for a lot of reasons. And Lord knows there's plenty of risk in agriculture, and crop insurance is designed to deal with that risk. And farmers pay premiums. They got skin in the game. They have to make an effort. They sit down with their agent. They decide which program is best for them. They worry about coverage levels. There's no freebie involved. Nevertheless, it is true that the U.S. government subsidizes about 60% of the cost of crop insurance. Anytime there's any kind of level of subsidy, you're going to have people question whether or not it's too much or whether or not, you know, the big guys should get it or whatever. And when you use it, when you got a number that says over half of the insurance costs is paid by the federal government, that just is going to invite other folks to say, boy, you know, I wish somebody would pay for over half of my property insurance and over half of my car insurance. You know, you can turn around and say, ultimately, this is for the good of the consumer. You want farmers to sign up for these programs and use them. And frankly, history teaches us that if they were priced at 100% of their actuarial cost, farmers wouldn't use them. And so we did this because we wanted farmers to take this approach as opposed to just getting a check in the mail. So there's plenty of room for debate about this. But I think at the end of the day, it's been pretty much decided that the general framework of crop insurance is good. And I'm sure over the next two or three farm bills, we'll debate whether or not farmers need to get more skin in the game.
We're talking about the cost of this out over 10 years, but how long is this bill in effect? I mean, previous bills, I think, weren't they like 5 years? Is this one 5 years? We have to do it all over again, or is it every 2 years? How does that work?
Yeah, exactly. The 10-year calculation is standard for Congress. They do that with every piece of new legislation, no matter what its duration is. Farm bills can be whatever Congress decides them to be, but we've been in this kind of five-year pattern now for quite a few times. So this bill expires at the end of 2018.
Okay. And then I know you have to leave in just a few seconds here, but I found one thing rather amusing in this legislation. There is actually a provision in it to encourage the study of the effects of industrial hemp. That made me smile. I thought, you know, only in America.
Okay. It's your government working for you.
There we go. We're from the government. We're here to help you. Professor, I know you have to leave to catch a cab. I really appreciate you getting up early and talking with us, and I'll just be singing show tunes for the rest of the hour here. But I thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Excellent. Happy to do it.
Andy Novakovic is a professor of agricultural economics at Cornell University and former chair of the Department of Agriculture's Dairy Industry Advisory Committee, and he is a proud UW River Falls graduate. What I want to do now is kind of open up the phones, and you can sound off about agricultural policy and things like that for the next 3 or 4 minutes. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. What did you think when you heard the Farm Bill had passed the House? If you're a farmer, were you happy with it? We'll take those calls. We'll start with Tom in South Beloit, Illinois. Tom, whoops, we lost Tom. Well, thanks, Tom. Okay, here's what's coming up after 8 o'clock this morning. I'll be talking with a young man who was diagnosed with fatal brain cancer, but decided to go on a personal priority list hunt and see how he's a teacher, see how his students were doing, and help them to discover their own priority lists. And he's going to share the lessons in life that he learned after 8. Tomorrow, here's what's coming up. President Obama is pushing for a couple of new trade deals in the Pacific and with Europe. Democrats are resisting. We're going to find out why on Point coming up. And then tomorrow at this time, we'll discuss the current state of rock and roll with music professor Peter Roller of Alverno College. And on tomorrow's Week in Review after 8, two guests from different perspectives debate and discuss the week's top headlines, including the president's State of the Union address and State Senator Dale Schultz's announcement that he is going to be retiring after this term. All right. Let's hear from Jeff in Dodgeville. Jeff, good morning.
Morning. My question is, was there money allocated in the Farm Bill for the Conservation Reserve Program?
Well, we don't have the professor on anymore, but yes, there was. That was one of the things. I don't know if it's the same amount of money, but that program, I believe, was preserved. Conservationists actually were pretty happy, I think, with the way that bill turned out. So it shouldn't be too difficult to find that out online. But the research I did to prep for this show indicates that that program was preserved in the Ag Bill. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Tom in South Beloit. Tom, good morning.
Good morning, John. When I've heard this thing about the country of origin labeling, it always struck me as I don't understand the excuse, because for years our pets, the dogs that I've had have had electronic chips in their ear or in their neck or something like that, and you track them from day one with that electronic chip that they have.
Yeah, I don't think the question has been keeping track of where the cattle are or where they've been, but it's about labeling the meat that we see in the grocery store by country of origin. I think that's been the issue. And if you're living up in Montana or down in Texas where you've got some borders, that can be a little bit of a complication there. I think that's probably where the dispute is coming from. All right. We're done talking about the Farm Bill. We're going to move on. Thanks so much to Bill Martins for producing this hour, Cynthia Schuster for acting as director, and Robin Cherry for on-air production. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.